Lecture 31, West and East Pakistan.
As Pakistan emerged out of the heated negotiations and even more fiery events of 1947, its citizens and competing political leaders had to determine the nature of their new nation. Many diverse groups and peoples have continued to clash over the vital and controversial issues during the subsequent 7 tumultuous decades of Pakistan's history down to the present. These issues include the relationships among the Pakistani nation, Islam, and the various diverse Muslim and non-Muslim communities living within and crossing Pakistan's borders. There is also the balance of power among the different regional ethnic groups and cultures of each of Pakistan's provinces. Yet another unsettled issue is the rivalry among the various branches of the government, including the legislature, the executive, the judiciary, the army, and the civil service. Each has at one or more times seized power. Only once in Pakistan's entire history to date has a democratically elected civilian government served its full term and then accepted a smooth transition to the next democratically elected government. The economic and social gaps among Pakistanis have also led to repeated clashes. Further, there is a destabilizing issue of cross-cutting and shifting international conflicts and alliances. Pakistan has gone to war 3 times against India. Pakistan has sometimes been a vital supporter of certain Afghan governments and also sometimes served as the base for anti-Afghan government insurgents. Pakistan has intermittently been subject to cold and hot war conflicts among the U.S., Russia, and China. And Pakistan remains the site of various conflicting and often violent transnationalist Islamist movements. Additionally, Pakistan now has a substantial nuclear weapons arsenal, a rapidly growing but widely unemployed youth, and a struggling economy. In order to discuss and illustrate these complex issues, we'll look selectively at chronological events and developments in Pakistan's history. In this lecture, we'll consider events up until Pakistan divided in 1971, with its western and eastern wings each becoming an independent nation. In the following lectures, we'll consider events from 1971 up to the present, concentrating first on what had been West Pakistan, but is now the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, and later on Bangladesh, formerly East Pakistan. On August 14, 1947, Pakistan gained independence after Jinnah and the Muslim League had successfully appealed to many Muslims at the ballot box and in the streets. In the years leading up to independence, the Muslim League's most powerful appeal was that Islam was in danger. Jinnah and his political allies asserted that any Muslim who voted against the League was a traitor to his religion. But once independence was secured, Jinnah, the new governor general, laid out quite a different and more secular vision for Pakistan. In his speech to the assembly that was about to write the Pakistani constitution and had just elected him its president, Jinnah directed, quote, "Every one of you, no matter to what community he belongs to, no matter what is his color, caste, or creed, is first, second, and last a citizen of this state with equal rights, privileges, and obligations." In course of time, all these angularities of the majority and minority communities, the Hindu community and the Muslim community, will vanish. You are free. You are free to go to your temples. You are free to go to your mosques or to any other places of worship in this state of Pakistan. You may belong to any religion or caste or creed. That has nothing to do with the business of the state. In the course of time, Hindus would cease to be Hindus and Muslims would cease to be Muslims, not in the religious sense, because that is the personal faith of each individual, but in the political sense as citizens of the state, end quote. But Jinnah, who had long known that he was dying of tuberculosis, did not live to implement this, his final vision for Pakistan. Instead, an inconsistent series of more religiously minded politicians, or at least politicians who wanted to appeal to the majority Sunni Muslim community, worked to make Pakistan a more Islamic state. Some groups who considered themselves good Muslims, like the Ahmadiyya community, have been legally declared non-Muslims. Many of the highest offices in government are explicitly reserved only for Muslims. At various times, laws have even been written that make non-Muslims vulnerable to discrimination. The current federal Sharia court has the power to override any law that conflicts with its interpretation of Islamic law. Much of the bombing, murder, and other violence going on in Pakistan today is between the majority Sunni and the minority Shiite Muslim communities. Further, inter-regional rivalries have always shaped Pakistan. Almost immediately upon independence in 1947, tensions arose between the nation's two separate Western and Eastern wings. These wings were culturally very different and located 1,000 miles apart across often hostile Indian territory. East Bengal comprised more than half of Pakistan's population, but almost all of the new nation's most prominent political and military leaders were based in the Western wing. Their vision of the new nation only imperfectly included Bengali Eastern Wing people. After all, there's no B for Bengal in the name of Pakistan, the nation. Pakistan is an acronym for Punjab, Afghania, Kashmir, Sindh, and Balochistan, all of which are located in the Western Wing. The name Pakistan also means the land of purity in Urdu. Pakistan's Qaid-e-Azam, or great leader, Jinnah, made his only visit to the country's Eastern Wing in March 1948. In a speech in English that alienated many people there, Jinnah directed them to use Urdu in place of their own language, Bengali. This was for many Bengalis an ominous warning that West Pakistani leaders considered them culturally inferior and even considered them not good Muslims. Yet being Muslim was the primary reason that Bengalis were part of Pakistan in the first place. This growing conflict between Pakistan's two wings would lead to their split in 1971, only a quarter century after Pakistan's independence. But within Pakistan's Western wing as well, there were major rivalries among provincially based ethnic identities. All of these competed with the imagined community of the Pakistan nation as a whole. Although the Punjab region had been divided between India and Pakistan at partition, the Pakistani part of the Punjab by itself held a substantial majority of West Pakistan's population, about two-thirds in fact. So one of the recurring tensions in West Pakistan has always been between Punjabis and all the other ethnic identities. Furthermore, the Punjab is the agricultural heartland of West Pakistan, with the major city of Lahore as its historic center. Pakistan's major military headquarters is in the Punjab, at Rawalpindi. And now the purpose-built capital, Islamabad, is located there too. Yet even within the Punjab, there are competing ethnic groups and sects of Muslims, as we'll see. West Pakistan's second largest province by population is Sindh. As you recall, this was the first part of South Asia that came under the rule of Muslims. But over the 13 centuries since then, an amalgamated Indian and Muslim culture developed. Sindhi literature, both written and oral, has many important works, including poems and songs of devotion to heterodox Sufi holy men. Although Sindh is not as agriculturally prosperous as is the Punjab, the Indus River has long irrigated the farmlands along its banks. While the port of Karachi is located on the Sindh coast, it remains culturally, politically, and economically somewhat apart from the rest of the province. Karachi was Pakistan's first national capital, and after independence, Karachi began to expand into Pakistan's industrial center. It has grown hugely, with the current population being more than 17 million people. But only a small minority of Karachi's inhabitants are ethnically Sindhi. Since independence, the city's politics and economy have been dominated by the self-styled Muhajir community. These are people whose families left North India and migrated to Pakistan at the time of partition. Many of them were refugees, driven out of their homes because they were Muslims. Others migrated to Pakistan out of a commitment to Islam or to the idea of a Muslim nation. Indeed, the name Muhajir carries powerful implications in Islam, since that was the honorable title given to the faithful people who fled Mecca along with the Prophet Muhammad and who first founded the first Muslim community in Medina. So many in the Muhajir community regard themselves as the most faithful of Pakistanis, having given up the most to create the new nation. In 1947, Muhajirs tended to be better educated and sometimes had more capital and experience with entrepreneurship than did Sindhis and other West Pakistanis. They often gained possession of the houses and businesses left behind in Karachi and some other cities in Sindh when Hindus left for India in 1947. To some extent, Muhajirs have also taken over much of the cultural, political, and military leadership of the entire nation of Pakistan. Their community's language is Urdu, which became the official language of Pakistan, although few outside the Muhajir community had that language as their mother tongue. Many of Pakistan's early leaders, including several military dictators and influential national religious figures, have been Muhajirs. So for many Sindhis and other ethnic groups in Pakistan, there is sometimes a sense that Muhajirs acted like carpetbaggers. They had been accepted as refugees, but they took over the entire nation. Plus, many Muhajirs are Shiites, which is the minority sect in Islam and in Pakistan. Many of their mosques and their people have been attacked by militant Sunnis as a result. Baluchistan is the region that is geographically largest and most richly endowed with some strategic natural resources, especially natural gas and uranium. But the Baluch people are among the poorest and most marginalized in Pakistan. They have received few economic benefits from those natural resources, which were extracted for use in Sindh and the Punjab. Ever since Pakistan's creation, Baluch cultural and political nationalists have been struggling for more control over their province, or even for independence. The Baluch comprise only about 3% of the population of West Pakistan. Since many Baluch people live in Iran or in Afghanistan, their nationalism cuts across what are today national boundaries. Baluch guerrilla movements have thus been fighting with varying degrees of intensity and violence against the Pakistani, Iranian, and Afghan governments for 7 decades. Even more, many Pashto-speaking Pakhtun people are also disputing the national boundaries that divide their ethnic community. In Pakistan, the province the British called the Northwest Frontier has been recently renamed Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, that is, the land of the Pakhtun people in the Khyber River region. You recall that the Khyber River flows from near Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, into the Indus River. So even this name asserts this ethnicity's transnational identity. From colonial times onward, a strategic part of this province has stood largely outside government control. This is FATA, the federally administrated tribal area, where Pakistani legal codes don't apply. Instead, Sharia or Islamic law is in force. Various Islamist groups are based there, most notably the Taliban of Pakistan. Additionally, the rival Taliban of Afghanistan, as well as Al-Qaeda, and increasingly the Islamic State, ISIL or ISIS, all have considerable support there. At present, indeed, for decades, the Pakistani army has struggled to assert control. In Afghanistan, much of the population is also Pakhtun. So Pakhtuns play a major role in the future of both Pakistan and Afghanistan. Additionally, Pakistan claims all of Kashmir, but only holds a third of it, known as Azad Kashmir, meaning Free Kashmir. While this region is not large in population or in economic terms, it is very significant politically and militarily. Kashmir has been the site of recurrent conflict between Pakistan and India over the last 70 years since independence. Until the people of Kashmir are convinced that they have received their rights and true national identity, the partition will not have been resolved. Finally, there are several former princely states that are now integrated into Pakistan. However, some princes held on to a high level of administrative autonomy for decades after they agreed to merge their kingdoms into the new nation of Pakistan. Even now, many of these royal dynasties hold residual respect and influence in their regions. This often translates into electoral power, giving some of these former princes a strong voice in Pakistani politics. Therefore, Pakistan has always had many stresses on its national identity, with many people showing stronger loyalties in provincially based ethnic terms. As we selectively look at Pakistan's history, we'll see how these religious and ethnic forces and tensions have interacted, and also how the Pakistan state's domestic and international configurations have shifted dramatically over time. Because Muhammad Ali Jinnah wanted to be a strong executive governor general, he established a presidential system of government, since the head of the executive branch holds the most political power. But that presidential model has only intermittently prevailed in Pakistan. Instead, following Jinnah's death just a year after independence, the head of the legislative branch, Prime Minister Liaquat Ali Khan, took over. This shift came even before the Constitution of Pakistan had been written, so there was no actual legal changes. Unlike Jinnah, who came from Karachi, Liaquat Ali Khan was a Muhajir from North India. He had long headed the Muslim League under Jinnah's direction, but they had different models for Pakistan. In contrast to Jinnah, Liaquat Ali Khan directed the same constitutional assembly to write a constitution that recognized Allah as Pakistan's sovereign, whereby, quote, "Muslims shall be enabled to order their lives in the individual and collective spheres in accordance with the teachings and requirements of Islam as set out in the Holy Quran and the Sunnah, or customs of the Prophet Muhammad," close quote. Non-Muslim minorities were to be protected, but, quote, "the state is not to play the part of neutral observer, because such an attitude on the part of the state would be the very negation of the ideas which prompted the demand of Pakistan. Instead, the state will create such conditions as are conducive to the building up of a truly Islamic society," close quote. So even before the constitution was drafted, Pakistan's first two leaders advocated distinct forms of government and foundations for the nation. But Liaquat Ali Khan also did not live to implement his vision for Pakistan either. He was assassinated in 1951, just 3 years after Jinnah's death. Eventually taking over the government in this dangerous time of instability was a businessman and former civil servant, Ghulam Muhammad. He used the office of governor general to seize power in order to quell escalating social violence. Some commentators have called this a civil service coup, since Ghulam Muhammad dismissed the legislature and looked to the civil service as well as the army's generals for support. Indeed, the civil service has from British colonial times onward been especially powerful in the territories that became Pakistan. The Pakistani Supreme Court's Chief Justice, Muhammad Munir, supported this coup under its newly coined, quote, "doctrine of necessity." This stated that that which is otherwise not lawful is made lawful by necessity. This doctrine will be used repeatedly in Pakistan to justify authoritarian actions by those in power. But just 4 years later, an ill Ghulam Muhammad was forced out by a retired general, Iskandar Mirza, who took over office and powers as governor general. Iskandar Mirza came from a highly anglicized and aristocratic family and had grown up in Bombay. He was the first Indian to graduate from the prestigious British Military Academy of Sandhurst. But he spent most of his career in the political service rather than performing military duties. In 1947, the outgoing British put him in charge of dividing the British Indian Army. General Iskandar Mirza himself then opted for Pakistan as a Muhajir. Then, as Pakistan's first defense secretary, he had proven his authoritarian administrative skills, directing the 1947 fighting against India. He had also commanded the violent suppression of popular nationalist movements in Balochistan and then in East Pakistan. As governor general, he instituted Pakistan's first constitution and was unanimously elected president by the new parliament. But his regime was unstable. In 1958, he had to turn to the army to quell widespread disorder, declaring martial law, abrogating the Young Constitution, and dismissing parliament. But within weeks, the man whom he'd appointed chief martial law administrator and head of the army, General Ayub Khan, forced Iskandar Mirza to go into exile in London. This was the first of four successful military coups in Pakistan's short history. In many former colonies around the world, the army is the strongest institution at the time of independence. It is disciplined, with a centralized command structure, often in contrast to the less developed other branches of the new state. More than half of Pakistan's history has been under military rule. Ayub Khan had also trained at Sandhurst and was a career army officer until his coup. During his 11-year reign, secularism and economic development, rather than Islam, guided his policies and the new constitution he imposed in 1962. Under his pro-business regime, the Pakistani economy expanded rapidly, with industrialists and other entrepreneurs flourishing. This improved Pakistan's GDP, but concentrated wealth in a small elite. Ayub Khan also strengthened the army's supervision over the government. He shifted the national capital from Karachi to a new planned city, Islamabad, in the shadow of the army's national headquarters in Rawalpindi. He also moved Pakistan into a military alliance with the U.S., providing a base for American U-2 spy planes flying over the Soviet Union. The U.S.-equipped Pakistani army fought its second war against Soviet-equipped India in 1965. In addition to Kashmir, there was a disputed border in the far south in the Ran of Kutch. This land was sometimes underwater, but during the dry part of the year, it was a salt flat, ideal for rapid tank combat. Despite a month of bitter fighting and a few thousand casualties, neither army gained much ground. But both India and Pakistan lost much foreign aid. Finally, the Soviet Union called the belligerents to Tashkent for peace negotiations. But Ayub Khan's government was weakened by the failure of the Pakistani army to achieve its much-promised victory over India. Economic disparities increased within both West and East Pakistan, and also between these two wings. Political unrest arose against his regime. This led in 1969 to yet another army force transfer of power, as General Yahya Khan took over as the chief martial law administrator and then as president of Pakistan. He suspended the Young Constitution, dissolved parliament, and replaced civilian with military administrators. This was a continuation of the domination by the army, which pushed aside the legislative and also the judicial branches of government. International and domestic criticism of military rule led Yahya Khan to bring at least one civilian into his government. He chose energetic Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who had served in several previous military-dominated cabinets since 1958. The Bhutto family were major landlords in the Sindh countryside. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto had grown up extremely wealthy and chose to go to the U.S. for college. He first enrolled in the University of Southern California, where he stood out as a popular figure on campus, known for his flamboyant parties. But he later transferred to the University of California at Berkeley. He then trained as a lawyer at Oxford and qualified for the bar in London. After his return to Pakistan, Bhutto soon took a leading role in politics. As an alternative to the military, he represented both the Sindhi landholding class and also a new vision of Pakistan. In 1967, Bhutto created the Pakistan People's Party in order to broaden his political base. This party reached out to the masses across Pakistan, although its core support was in Sindh province. Ideologically, Bhutto combined an appeal to Islam with promises of socialism. Indeed, Islamic socialism was attractive for many progressive politicians across the Muslim world during that period. Bhutto also combined a commitment to democracy with a slogan that he took from the American Black Panther movement, "All power to the people." Influenced by Bhutto, General Yahya Khan declared a national election late in 1970 to elect a new constitutional convention that would be succeeded by a national assembly. This was really the first popular democratic election in Pakistan's history, coming more than two decades after independence. Led by the charismatic Bhutto, the Pakistan People's Party won a strong majority of all the seats in West Pakistan. But the PPP won none of the seats in the eastern wing of the nation. In East Pakistan, another dynamic political leader, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, led the Awami League Party to a resounding victory, winning twice as many seats as the PPP. Indeed, since the eastern wing had a majority of Pakistan's population, the Awami League won a majority of seats in the entire body. As we'll see when we discuss the emergence of Bangladesh, Mujibur Rahman had appealed successfully to Bengali sentiments. But Yahya Khan and other West Pakistani politicians regarded the Awami League as secessionist or even treasonous. Rather than recognize the shift of political power from West to East Pakistan, Yahya Khan suspended the start of the newly elected body. He also sent in a large part of the Pakistani army to, as he saw it, restore order in the East. In Operation Searchlight, the Pakistani army and its local militant supporters in the East used force to arrest or even kill political and cultural leaders. The violence escalated, and there were mass executions. About 10 million East Pakistanis fled as refugees into India. Many of the young male refugees were organized and equipped by the Indian army into the Mukti Bahini, or Freedom Force, that waged bloody guerrilla war against the Pakistani army. As international pressure intensified on Pakistan to halt this repression and recognize the outcome of the election, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto defended the Pakistani government heatedly. He spoke forcefully at the United Nations against these international designs to intervene in the internal affairs of the sovereign state of Pakistan. When he failed to persuade the international community, Bhutto threw his papers in the air and dramatically strode out of the UN Assembly. After a brief war, the third between Pakistan and India, the Indian Army captured the entire Pakistani army posted in the East, almost 100,000 soldiers. This partitioned the two wings of Pakistan into separate nations. As both the electoral victor in the West, which was now all that was left of Pakistan, and as its most popular and fervent defender, Bhutto set aside Yahya Khan and himself took over as the first civilian chief martial law administrator and then as president. This ended the long period from 1955 until 1971 that the Pakistani army had controlled Pakistan's government. But for the next 6 years, the civilian politician Zulfikar Ali Bhutto dominated and instituted a dramatically new regime for the Pakistani nation, as we'll see in our next lecture.